Welcome, everybody, to the 67th episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan. I'm very excited to welcome first-time guest, Dr. Rivka Press-Schwartz, to the show. Welcome, Dr. Press-Schwartz.
Thank you so much for having me.
My absolute pleasure. So for those less familiar with Dr. Press-Schwartz here, she currently serves as Associate Principal of General Studies at SAR High School in the Bronx in New York City. She earned her PhD in basically on the Manhattan Project, on the cultural history of the Manhattan Project. She lectures widely on issues of contemporary importance in the Orthodox community, and she also serves on the faculty of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. So I'm very excited to have Dr. Press-Schwartz here. Welcome.
Thank you.
I was initially alerted to Dr. Press-Schwartz. I think it was Rabbi David Wolkenfeld who pointed out her deeply intriguing essay from 2012 in the Orthodox Forum called Privilege, Perspective, and Modern Orthodox Youth. Really fascinating for anybody who hasn't read it and cares about modern orthodoxy. It's deeply intriguing and fascinating. I have also appreciated her tweeting and her recent appearance on the 1840 podcast to be quite interesting. So the through line that I would like to say that I have noticed, this is for anybody listening or watching out there, this is our very first interaction. So I don't actually know Dr. Press-Schwartz in any sort of level, but what's really stood out to me about all those various media of hers is her deep level of cause, of concern for various people and institutions. And that's what carries us forward into our topic of this present episode, which is her JTA op-ed she published in February with Rabbi Tuli Hartstark. Yes, Hartstark, I did pronounce it correctly. The data don't lie. Yeshiva high school students have a binge drinking problem. Here's what we can do about it. So that is where the Jewish drinking angle comes in. And like I said, from the previous setup, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Press-Schwartz, but what has really struck me about what you have published out there is really this this concern, and not just about modern Orthodox, but even about, especially through your tweeting, is sort of broader national people and institutions, right? And I think that that's what ties us into our present conversation about both modern Orthodox high schools and their students.
I'll take it. Sure.
Okay, sounds great. Good. I do want to ask you for a little bit of a clarification, and this may help some of our listeners. What specifically are the demographics? When you talk about Yeshiva high school students, what specifically, and this is in the greater New York City area, what specifically, like in the ideological spectrum, are we talking about?
Great question. So first I'll say it wasn't just the New York City area. The first year that we did the surveying in 2019, we also had some schools participating from outside the New York City area. As we started to think about what an intervention might look like to address the issues that the survey raised, it became clear to us that we were only going to be able to target the interventions in the New York City area. And then we focused the second round of surveying that we did in 2020, more specifically in the New York City area. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who are familiar with the New York City area, you know that we have this thing called the Yeshiva League, which is the Orthodox high schools that play sports against each other. And that basically means all of the high schools that identify broadly with the centrist or modern Orthodox world. It's not the Yeshiva or Haredi high schools, which generally don't participate in sports leagues, but everybody who identifies from across the spectrum of schools who are sending their students to Yeshiva College, Stern College, secular colleges, single-sex schools, co-ed schools, it's basically everybody who considers themselves to be religious Zionist and marches in the Salute to Israel parade. And if that sounds like a funny way to identify schools, they play basketball together and they march in this parade every June together. But that actually gives you a broad sense, communally speaking, of who it is that we are speaking to and speaking about.
How did you decide to undertake the survey? You mentioned in both 2019 and when I say 2020, this is pre-pandemic 2020?
Yeah, so it was actually fascinating. We did the survey in 2019 on February 27th. For logistical reasons, that's just how it worked out. And so when we decided to do a second round of surveying, and maybe we'll get around to talking about exactly how that happened in 2020, for sentimental reasons, we decided to do it on February 27th again.
Oh, wow.
So we did a second round of surveying exactly 1 year later. On March 3rd, SAR High School became one of the first in the group of the first schools on the East Coast to shut down because of COVID. It was us and a couple of other schools together because of a family in the SAR community. And so on March 3rd, we were shut down, and then that was that. And part of the story is that the surveys had been done, and some schools had their survey responses sitting in their school buildings collecting dust for 6 months. And it wasn't until the schools reopened in September that we actually physically got the survey responses sent back to Utah, where our survey research data analysis firm was going to actually process the survey results and get us meaningful data out of them.
So that was a part of the story. So I don't know if, I mean, obviously there's a certain intentionality about releasing these, the data in February right before Purim, but it sounds like part of that was this delay due to the pandemic of the half year of both getting the data and then ultimately it being processed.
We did not start off by saying, let's release it around Purim. we had all the issues that we had in getting the data gathered and processed. And then there was a long, there are a lot of schools involved here. There are a lot of other people and a lot of stakeholders involved here. And so everything takes longer and moves more slowly when you're bringing a lot of other people along with you.
The data you gather is from three grades, 10th, 11th, 12th grade. And as you mentioned, it's not strictly the greater New York City area. It's,
Let me stop you.
Yeah, go for it.
We gather data from 10th and 12th graders each year.
And the 10th and 12th, that, but not 11th?
10th, 12th, but not 11th.
Oh, wow.
The reason we did that is the federal government has been, since 1975, which is technically speaking longer than I've been alive, gathering data about substance use and attitudes towards substance use and other problematic behaviors by American high school kids. And so, and they, the federal government, in this project called Monitoring the Future, surveys 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. So we have a trove of national data to compare ourselves to each year and going back 45 years.
Wow.
And so it makes sense to give the survey to the exact parallel populations so we can compare our data to national data.
Hmm. So you already sort of had that rubric to some degree in place.
Yes.
Right.
And the survey that we used, which was not our survey, again, we contracted with a survey and research firm called Bach Harrison to do the data analysis. They also provided us with the survey instrument, which is largely similar to the survey that the federal government uses for the Monitoring the Future survey. Again, the data would be comparable.
When you say we, is that you and Rabbi Hartstark? Was it SAR? Who convened the survey?
So the survey was convened by Machon Siach, which is the research arm of SAR High School dedicated to the memory of Belda K. Lindenbaum. And we have the unique opportunity of being able to do research projects like this under the aegis of a high school. That's not a typical thing that happens in high schools. with the support of the Lindenbaum family and with really Rabbi Tolly Hartstark having this vision and this dream for a long time of being able to do high school-based communal research.
Wow.
We started thinking about substance use in modern Orthodox high schools. We're very intentional about that framing of substance use, not abuse. We aren't talking about the relatively smaller number of kids who get identified as problem users. And we're talking about the much larger population of kids who are using substances and what passes for normal high school drinking culture or substance using culture. And that's what we wanted to address.
Hmm.
We started thinking about it and we really didn't have any idea what we were doing, to be perfectly honest, because we're not prevention researchers or substance use researchers. And so we reached out to educators from a number of different high schools and pulled them together and said, we want to start thinking about this. We really don't know what or how. We just have the sense, like you have the sense, this is a problem. It's getting worse. We'd like to tackle it. And this goes back, you know, 2 years ago, at least. We got together a group of educators from a couple of different high schools. And the night before we met for the first time, I hope he doesn't mind my specifically naming him on this. I can't imagine why he would. Rabbi Dov Emerson of Yeshiva University High School for Boys sent us a short video about work that had been done in Iceland, a project to tackle substance use and specifically drinking by teenagers in Iceland by mobilizing an entire community to shift community culture, to find the places where substance use happened, to change the opportunities and the lack of opportunities, the access, the unsupervised time. And we watched all of this the night before we gathered for the first time. We said, huh, what do you know? There's something that can be done. And that works. And it doesn't sound like any of the things we're doing right now, which is either let's bring in a speaker to talk to the kids about alcohol, or let's punish the kids if we catch them doing something that violates school rules and policy. And neither one of those is doing us a ton of good, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing them, and yet we feel like the problem is getting worse. And here was a wildly different approach. This intervention has been ongoing in Iceland for decades. So when I say folks, I mean, they have data and research about this in Iceland for decades. There's a whole long story to that that goes on that I'm not going to tell you, but we ended up connecting both with the leader of the Iceland group, but also with a group based in the United States called Communities That Care, based out of the University of Washington, funded by the federal government, doing similar kinds of community mobilization efforts. And they've been guiding us ever since to gather the data and then, which we have already done, and to start thinking about interventions and implementing them, what that would look like, which we haven't gotten to yet.
I'm still super duper fascinated by this idea of funding for surveys out of, or studies out of a high school. Is that anywhere else, or is that a specific sort of brainchild of Rabbi Hartstark?
I'm not sure that it's anywhere else, to be honest. I can't tell you that I've done a comprehensive, you know, assessment of every high school in the United States. I certainly haven't heard of it anywhere else. And the broad contours of Machon Siach, of a research institute based out of a high school, it's certainly the specific brainchild of Rabbi Hartstark. It actually started off more as an idea that faculty would have an opportunity to do research and to step back from the immediacy of the classroom, of curriculum and planning and assessment and parent teacher conferences, as I was doing tonight, and would have space instead for deeper research and reflection. But then as we stepped back and as we thought about what are the biggest issues, problems, challenges confronting our kids today, some of them lent themselves to that kind of research by faculty members. And this one, the substance issue, we started by saying, let's have our own faculty members think about it and research it. And then we said, well, our kids are actually not just engaging in substance consumption with other kids from SAR. Our kids are getting together across schools, across communities, across the Yeshiva League. And so if we're going to tackle this as an issue, it can't just be with us alone. It has to be with reaching out to other high schools. And that's when we reach out to other high schools to say, we don't know what we want to do about this, but we want to do something. Are you in? And then Rabbi Emerson sent us the Iceland video, and the rest, I guess, is history.
That's great. I have to ask one other tangential question, which is, what other studies are being pursued through Machon Siach?
So right now, we don't have any of other of these kinds of broad studies reaching out across multiple high schools, but there are at least a couple of other ones that we're considering doing. There's always the challenge of what they call survey fatigue, especially when we just show up every year and we're like, here's 300 more questions we'd like your students to answer. But I will say, even about this specific survey, we piggybacked on it. Once we were giving out this nationally normed substance use survey, we said, let's also gather data about things that we are interested in about our kids' religious engagement and commitment and practice. And so we added on questions to an already very long survey, added questions at the end about all of these things. We worked with Jake Trumbo, the guy I work with at Bach Harrison at the survey and research firm, who I've been working with for years and whom I've never seen. At one point, we scheduled a Zoom meeting with him, and I was like, finally, I'm at least going to see what Jake looks like. But he came on the Zoom without his video on. I talked to him on the phone. I emailed him, and I've been working with this guy for years. I have no idea what the guy looks like. But anyway, Jake Trumbo worked with us to craft questions that would gather meaningful data for us. So I have this guy in Utah who's helping me write a question about, you know, going to shul on Shabbos. Do you go to shul just for Shacharit, for Kabbalat Shabbat, for Mincha, for what these words mean? Like survey question as we try to get a handle on kids' level of religious observance and engagement. And so we have data from that as well, in addition to having data from all the substance questions. And that data is fascinating. Data are fascinating. I will also say that the PNA survey itself, the main survey instrument, is not just about drinking and drugs. It also asks questions about kids' emotional well-being, about their connections to parents and adults in their lives. It asks questions about what they call other antisocial behavior, which includes violence, gambling, stealing cars, you name it, gang activity, the whole gamut of all kinds of things. So we actually have a very, very robust probe of data here. And we do have other researchers who are now interested in getting their hands on it and analyzing it. Because there's a lot here that hasn't been gathered before, and there might be more interesting things yet to find out.
So I think we've done enough teasing about the data. I'm ready to dive in. So I see that in the JTA piece that you and Rabbi Hartstark published, that one of the findings was that the national data show that 22% of students have taken more than just a taste or a sip in the past 30 days, compared with 38% of students in our community. So I guess that's the national data versus the specific Yeshiva High School data. And then 11% of students nationally say they have binged 5 or more drinks in a sitting, compared with 17 to 19% of students in this Yeshiva High School community. So were those findings surprising?
It's easy for me to go back now and kind of retrofit an explanation for those data, but the short answer is yes. And I will couple that with the data also show that there is less marijuana use and less vaping in our community than the national average. And I think that we went into the survey, meaningfully less marijuana and meaningfully less vaping. I think we went into the survey expecting to find that marijuana and vaping were going to be our big highlight problems. Certainly that's been where we've invested a lot of energy over the past few years. We, like some other of our peer schools, have installed vape detectors in the bathrooms. We've told students about this. We're not trying to catch anyone. We just want to make sure that vaping isn't going on. We want to create a healthy and safe school environment for everybody. We've spoken with other schools. We know that other schools have taken similar steps. Everybody's trying to make sure we get this new form of substance consumption under control. And while we're focusing on this and thinking about this and worrying about this, the largest problem in our community, the data tell us, and again, well, I'll let me finish the sentence and then largest problem in our community is drinking, and specifically binge drinking. Now, when I say our community, I want to say something clearly. We knew that in order for this study to work and in order for these interventions to work, we all had to be in it together. As soon as there was a whiff or a hint of there being invidious distinctions made, this school is better than that school, this school is better than the average, that school is worse than the average, which inevitably some schools are going to be, everybody will run away from participating in the study. Nobody wants to participate in a study and then have it said that their school is the school that's worse than the average, their school is the school that has more substance use. And so we promised the schools, we committed, that we were only going to gather aggregate data. We were not going to break out specific schools. Somebody asked me today about SAR and its own data. And I said, no, we promised only aggregate data. It would not do for us to promise that and then say, well, but for us, we get our own data. So we don't have SAR's broken out data either. And obviously there's an enormous interest in and desire to have that data. There are ways in which it would be incredibly meaningful to know what's going on in my own school. But the cost is too high. The gain is less than the loss, because as soon as schools, if schools had to worry that the data could somehow get out or be used against them, they wouldn't want to participate in the study. And so when I say our community, I mean as broadly as possible, the centrist and modern Orthodox community, this Yeshiva League community, this community of religious Zionist schools. I have no idea what specific numbers in SAR look like or in anyone else's school. But broadly in our community, less marijuana use, less vaping than the national average, which I think I don't know if we would have expected that, but more binge drinking, I know I didn't expect that.
I want to pick up less vaping than and marijuana use than you had expected. Like you had expected more or even somehow comparable to the national average?
I think that in the amount of time we spent talking and thinking about it and then, you know, focusing on it, attending to it, we would have expected that if anything would have presented as a significant, again, it's a little bit hard to put yourself back in the place of not knowing once you know. What did I think about the survey before we did it? But yes, I think that I thought that we were looking for vaping and marijuana use. I do. I think that's where I thought I was going to find our problems or our, I certainly remember being very surprised to look at binge drinking numbers for the community as a whole that were meaningfully higher than the national average. That was not a finding that I would, because we do have a tendency to think of ourselves as a community as, you know, we have healthier and more stable family and communal structures, and we have strong religious connection. And we think all of these positive things about ourselves as a community. We do, certainly when compared to the United States of America as a whole. And then to find out that we have substantially more binge drinking, I do think that required some rearranging of the mental furniture.
It's so fascinating to be talking about that. I mean, A, on the one hand, it's, you know, this episode's releasing on April 20th. It's a big smoking day for those who choose that direction. But this is not the Jewish smoking show. I'm more interested in the drinking aspects. So so what do you do about that? I mean, how much, you mentioned, and I don't know what type of messaging or other, events or speakers that you have to talk about what you were talking about, the vaping and marijuana use. Is there much that, at least prior to the survey or the study, how much has there been messaging about drinking?
Well, I don't know that I know the answer to that across all of the high schools there. In SAR High School, we teach a health course in 10th grade, which addresses substance use, including alcohol. We spend a good chunk of time on it. Certainly, I know that other schools are telling their kids around Purim, around Simchas Torah, you can't drink, don't drink, there will be consequences if you drink. The schools are imposing consequences on kids who host parties or have parties or get drunk on parties. So there is clear messaging that this is not something we want our kids to be participating in. Mm-hmm. And there are consequences sometimes being imposed on kids who are found to have participated or when bad things happen. And there are speakers being brought in, although I will say that I think that the community speakers in recent years have focused more on the drugs than on the alcohol, but there are speakers being brought in to schools or to community organizations and schools in the communities that I'm connected to and I know something about. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to be having the desired effect. And that was what led us in the first place to go looking for what else might be out there. Mm-hmm. And what we learned from both the Iceland intervention and the Communities That Care model is that kids can't be viewed as independent actors. Yes, they have choices to make. Yes, they make choices and decisions. But they're operating in a community context and they're making those choices and decisions in a community context. And if you're going to tackle problematic substance use, let's say in this case, problematic drinking, that's going to have to be done in a community context. Mm-hmm. So the way the Communities That Care does it, CTC does it, is they look at a number of risk factors that have been shown again over the many decades that we've been gathering this information to contribute to kid problematic behavior and protective factors that protect against kid problematic behavior. Mm-hmm. And then you look at your own community. Where are our risk factors high? We need to lower them. Where are our protective factors low? We need to raise them.
I wanted to take a break and pause to provide listeners with a sneak peek into next week's episode, Wine at Bris Milah Ceremonies, featuring Rabbi Chaim Leiter.
Once a cup has a blessing done over it, mm-hmm. you're not supposed to make another blessing over it until you've added a little bit to it.
I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek. And now back to our episode with Dr. Press Schwartz. What are the leading factors that are causing the modern and centrist Orthodox high school students to be drinking higher than their national contemporaries?
The national survey is not quite going to get us to everything that we need to know here, because there are risk factors it points to that I could talk about in a minute and protective factors it points to, but there are things about our community that are specific to our community. So that, for example, the risk factor points to adult modeling is a risk factor for substance use. Okay. What adult modeling looks like in our community is a little bit different than it might in the country as a whole. And we have to think about that, right? What does Shabbos look like in our communities? What does Smachot look like in our communities? What does Yom Tov look like in our communities? Parsing out, someone just said something to me about Purim. I don't know what to say, I don't so much buy that, honestly. If our kids were drinking once a year because they thought they had a halachic obligation to drink on Purim, and in the context of a Purim Seuda, they were getting very drunk on Purim, it wouldn't be my personal cup of tea or a cup of whatever as to how to celebrate Purim. But that would not be the problem we're talking about. We did the survey at the end of February, which is actually helpful because the binging question asks about in the past 2 weeks. So we were not within 2 weeks post-Purim. We were before Purim. And we weren't within 2 weeks before Pesach. If you're worried about, you know, the four cups of wine that they're confounding the data, we were just 2 weeks post the middle of February. There are broader questions about how our community uses alcohol and consumes alcohol and exposed to alcohol, what kids are seeing from adults around them. That we have to think about. So yes, certainly we're looking at national models and national patterns and national norms to compare ourselves to, but also the Iceland model is, what are the specifics of our community? What are the places where in our community kids access alcohol or kids have free time that's not being filled, that they fill with substances? And part of the intervention is gonna have to be thinking specifically about our communities and what they look like.
Are there any factors you wanna guess about or speculate?
You know, the adult modeling is a big one. And I want to say so strongly and so clearly that this is not a push towards teetotaling. It is not a push towards banning alcohol. I will personally say this is not the research study speaking, and this is not the researcher speaking. This is me personally maybe speaking. I think that the kind of shuls going dry and banning alcohol at kiddish, I won't say it's counterproductive, but I think it makes us feel like we're accomplishing things that we're not accomplishing. The shul goes dry. We ban alcohol at Kiddush, and in some places, in some communities, heavy consumption of alcohol on Shabbos just migrates into people's homes. So we haven't stopped heavy consumption of alcohol. At best, we can say maybe the shul sends some institutional message, but if the kids are still seeing heavy consumption of alcohol going on, I think the question is, what are we as adults modeling and conveying as values? Understanding the value we want to convey in most cases is not no alcohol ever, can't ever drink anything, that's the right way to be. That's not the value we're looking to convey. But we are probably looking to convey a value of some kind of moderation, some kind of appropriate use by the right people at the right time in the right way, and asking ourselves whether that's what our kids are seeing or not. So very much, you know, teetotaling, abstinence only, going dry, not the goal of this intervention, but thinking about a whole of community approach. So it's not about kick it out of the shul and then it's not my problem. It's about a whole of community approach. What are we as adults conveying? What are kids seeing? That's the one.
How widespread is it that shuls go dry? I know. Maybe how many of them are there doing that? Is it fairly common? Is it a noticeable minority?
I do not have data on that. I know of some high profile shuls in the New York area that have done it. I do not know how widespread that is. So I can't say that that's a phenomenon, but even things like controlling the alcohol at Kiddush and Shul or banning the Kiddush Club or any one of these kinds of things, not that there isn't value in the shul making a statement about its principles, just like schools make statements about their principles, but if we actually want to change kid behavior, we're changing community and we're changing culture. We're not banning in this institution or banning in that institution. We're thinking about what are the circumstances for everybody and how do we shift them for everybody. So there's a question on that survey about how many adults do you know who've gotten drunk or high in the past year for the teenagers to answer.
Yeah.
It's not a question about how many adults you know who've consumed alcohol. It's a question about adults you know who've gotten drunk or high. And you know, you'll be unsurprised, I think, probably, or it accords with our instincts to hear that when kids say they know five or more adults who've gotten drunk or high in the past year, those kids, a much higher percentage of them, will have used themselves.
Oh, wow.
Now, there's a lot that data don't tell us. What does adults mean? Does adult mean my older sibling who's in college who's getting drunk? Does adult mean my parents and their friends? Does adult mean, right? So it's true.
Yeah.
There's a lot I don't know there. There's more I need to know, but that's something I need to know. We don't yet have a clear understanding of to what extent that use might be correlated. Here are two hypotheses, and they came to us from two different principals of two different schools. So it might be they're true in two different school communities.
Okay.
One principal said, I think my kids are feeling a lot of college pressure, get into a top school, a lot of academic pressure, a lot of grades, a lot of stress, and this is how they blow off steam. Another principal.
Wait, the high schoolers are blowing off steam through the drinking?
Yes.
Okay, wow. All right.
Another principal said to us, oh, I don't see that in my school at all. I don't see that much academic pressure or stress. What I see is kids who on Friday night, they're making a tish. And part of the tish culture is you drink at the tish. And on Shabbos morning, they're having a kiddush. And part of the kiddush culture is you drink at the kiddush. And it's much more connected to times of religious engagement, or I won't say religious, Jewish collective communal engagement. And they think that the way of expressing that or experiencing that is through alcohol. So clearly within, even within our relatively limited centrist and modern Orthodox community, there are different ways stuff's getting consumed, different ways people are using it. But a question that might be common for both of those groups, for example, is where are they getting the alcohol? So the survey asks that question. If you drank alcohol, where'd you get it? Did you have a straw buyer buy it for you? Did someone over 21 get it for you? Did you get it at home with your parents' permission? And then there are other questions that ask, where'd you drink the alcohol? So those are all, a lot of kids getting, say they're getting it home with their parents' permission.
Wow. I don't know what to say. It's crazy. I'm just,
you know,
dumbfounded by that.
The idea of a public health approach, which is what this is, a public health approach is the opposite of like, find someone who's doing something bad and call them out and shame them and punish them. That is the opposite of a public health approach. A public health approach is to try to change overall the incentives or the structures or the norms within a community. So you move from ones that push towards less healthy behavior to ones that push towards more healthy behavior. So we are not interested here in saying, shame, shame, you are doing something terrible. Whether that's you as the parents or the kids or the shuls or the rabbis or the community or the institutions or the Baalei Simcha or whatever it is. Shame, shame, you are doing something terrible is not the approach we want to take. We want to say, where is this happening? When is this happening? Under what circumstances is this happening? And what can we do to shift the culture?
Could you do some sort of, like, is it possible to do some sort of parental education around this? It doesn't even have to be such a frontal education. It could be sort of like having conversations and confronting them with different things to consider. Is that Is that something you've thought about? I mean, what, before you started telling me about the kids getting the access of alcohol directly from their parents, I was thinking maybe if they, because you mentioned the modeling aspect. So I was thinking maybe along the lines of maybe it's something around the discourse around alcohol consumption that the parents could shepherd and think about and share with their kids. I don't know. What ways forward have you considered?
So there are really two. And again, one broadly comes from the CTC model, the Community Set Care model, from these researchers in the United States, and the other one comes from the Iceland model. The CTC model does include things like sitting with parents, not educating them. This is not about, let me tell you what's bad about alcohol consumption. It's actually asking parents to clarify and to articulate their own values around this. And then to say, are we communicating to our kids what our values are? Are we acting in ways that are consistent with what we articulate our values to be? I'm not telling you what your values should be. I'm actually just asking you to articulate for yourself what your values around that are. And then we can think about whether we're acting in ways that are consistent with that. And we're, and so those kinds of things might be more reflected in the CTC model. The Iceland model was more about saying, when are kids using? In what circumstances are kids using? And what can we do to change those circumstances? So I'll give you an example from the Iceland model, which is very compelling to me in a particular circumstance in our community. One of the things they said in Iceland is that teenagers are hanging out at night. They're like out in the bustling metropolis of Reykjavik getting into trouble, getting up in the road. And so what they said is, we are going to have a curfew in Reykjavik, not imposed by the police, not enforced by the law, but groups of parents walking around the streets. And if they see teenagers out, they're going to say to teenagers, it's after 10 o'clock, you're supposed to be home. You shouldn't be out on the streets now. And the parents doing this said, mostly kids comply. When we say to kids after 10 o'clock, they're supposed to be home, and they know they've been educated, they're supposed to be home, they mostly don't start up or fight back. The parents are not law enforcement officers. They don't have badges. They don't have guns. They're not arresting anybody. They're just reinforcing social norms. And most of the time that works. Hmm. I think about that in our communities. If you live in a suburban New York City community with a high Orthodox Jewish population, it is entirely possible that on Simchas Torah, you have seen drunken teenagers staggering around your streets. Kids gather. They go to other kids' homes. They gather in. I don't quite know what plays out, whether parents think their kids are just going to visit a friend, or they kind of know what's going on, or they really know what's going on. But the idea of having groups of parents who agree to patrol the streets on the last overnight and send kids home and be present and be out and be visible, instead of we're all home in our rooms and our teenagers are out on the street getting up to who knows what. To me, that's actually an interesting model to think about. Have I tried to do this? No, I have not. Have I asked parents to list all over, you know, our communities in Nassau County and Bergen County and Westchester County to sign up for shifts walking the streets? Nope, I haven't done any of that. But the Iceland model suggests that that actually has the potential to be effective. If you think about things like saying some combination of what are the times, places, specific, you know, where kids get into trouble and what can we do to target those? That's more sort of like the Iceland model. And the Communities That Care model, which says this is a community, where do we need to have education, involvement? Who needs to be involved in this discussion? Is it the parents? Is it the shul rabbis? Is it the local police chiefs? Is it, I don't know who it is, who needs to be involved in working together on this to shift culture? I'll say one more thing. I know we got a little bit far afield from the conversation about risk and protective factors, but I will say actually when we look at our risk and protective factors, on most measures, we look like we're doing very well.
Oh, okay.
Religiosity is a protective factor. Our kids have twice the religiosity, more than twice the religiosity of American kids as a whole, which, like, you know, I kind of would hope so. So yay us. Those risk and protective factors, we should be trying to elevate the ones, you know, elevate the protective factors that are lower and lower the risk factors that are higher. In general, our profile on those looks very good. Here's one thing that was consistent in both years we did the study that was painful for us to see. And then I'm telling you, I don't quite know what to make of it. There are a whole bunch of categories of protective factors. And one of them, they're broken out by peer and individual, community, and school. And there are things like, do you have opportunities to do what's called pro-social behavior? Are you provided with opportunities to do positive and good things? And then are you rewarded for pro-social behavior? So if you do positive and good things, you do chesed activities, you get involved in, will your friends think you're cool? Will your friends think that's positive? Will your friends think that's good? Okay, that's the measure. And then what about your community and what about your school? Both years, we rated lower than the national average on school rewards for pro-social behavior. Meaning, if I do something good, will my school recognize and acknowledge me and let my parents know that I've done something good? Will they tell me? And will they tell my parents if they think I've done something good?
Wow.
That's hard to see. Here we are. We are a school system. Staffed. I know lots of Jewish educators, not just in my own school. I know lots of Jewish educators and schools across the board. We have incredibly impressive people with incredible dedication, devoting their life to our kids, Torah and general education, because they believe in the mission of our schools. People are enormously dedicated and giving endless amounts of time. And somehow when we ask our kids, if the school notices when you're doing the right thing, lets you know and lets your parent know, our kids are telling us, again, the collective us, the community. I don't know data school by school. Our kids are telling the collective us 2 years in a row that we are less good at that than a national average drawn from kids of all kinds of schools all over the country. That's really hard to hear. What do you make of that? Like, how do you think about that? So one of the educators, again, we've been doing this in partnership with educators from a whole bunch of other schools, said, well, I think it's because the expectations are so much in terms of religious observance, in terms of mitzvah observance. We want kids to be doing so many things. And the sense is that's an obligation. That's a have to. You don't get a gold star if you do that. We don't say, yay, you daven today. We say, you got to daven everything. If you don't show up to davening on time, you're going to get davening demerits and you're going to get consequences. Yeah. We don't say, hey, you kept Shabbos this week. We expect you're going to keep Shabbos every single week. And if you don't, that's going to be a big problem. Is that the answer? That's a hypothesis that a school principal has, right? The data are the data. I can tell you what the data say. The data say that our kids are rating us as less good than the national average on this particular measure. The explanations for the data are the things that we hypothesize off of the data. I can't tell you that that's the right answer. That's one answer someone came up with. But that sense that we aren't doing a good enough job telling our kids when they're doing the right thing, that was really powerful. Here's one other thing that was really interesting to me. Our kids both say that they would get peer reinforcement for doing pro-social things. Their friends would think they were good and positive and cool if they got involved in chesed, which is in fact what we see. In our schools, in our communities, kids are not looked at as being nerdy or dweeby or losers for getting involved in friendship circle, for getting involved in, you know, 100 amazing causes that our kids get involved. And our kids are looked at positively for getting involved in those causes.
That's great.
But also, when asked about peer reward for antisocial behavior, they also rate that, would your peers think you're cool if you drank, if you used, if you whatever? Also, and that's fascinating to us. And that, I think, is something that I knew already going in. That for us, we somehow see a contradiction between being heavily involved in chesed or Torah or whatever it is, and also binge drinking. I'm like, how could the same kid be both of those things?
I just see it as they get a lot of peer, like, you know, positive reinforcement for whether it's the pro-social or the antisocial stuff.
But it's also our kids are not experiencing that as a contradiction, which is very interesting. They are not experiencing it as it's inconsistent or somehow going against our values. And that, again, leads back to interesting questions about what our values are and what we're communicating and where they're hearing and who they're hearing them from. Because our kids seem to be capable of both high levels of pro-social involvement and higher than the national average levels of anti-social involvement at the same time without experiencing that as somehow being a contradiction.
Unless you just flatten it and say they experience a lot of, you know, positive feedback for social, you know, forgetting the anti or the pro. It's just social involvement. Like, we are a high modern and centrist orthodoxy are very, very into social stuff. Like, just, you know, the peer-to-peer stuff.
Right. And
that for better, for worse, for better, for worse. We're all about the community aspects and other people.
Right. That might relate to our broader community, both being there for each other in an enormous way with chesed and stuck and all kinds of other wonderful things, and also being there for each other in a lot of ways that are being together, maybe in ways that are less healthy. Again, I want to be very clear here. It's important to be very clear, not to get out over our skis, as they say. The data tell us what data tell us. And we didn't spend a lot of time on this, but we could spend a lot of time on why we think the data are as reliable as we think they are. What are the measures to make sure that we've gotten good data and that the data are valid and meaningful? People ask all the time, won't the kids just lie? Won't they just fill out the surveys and say whatever? Well, if they're filling out the surveys and saying just what we wanted to hear, I don't think we've gotten this data about binge drinking. But so leaving aside for a second the question of validity measures and why we trust the data are the data. But our interpretations for the data are not are just our interpretations. They're our hypotheses. We have not done the work to validate or invalidate any of those hypotheses. And so I want to separate out the data in which we have confidence and our hypotheses, which are our hypotheses. You could take them or leave them. You could offer your own. We're trying to be very careful about what it is that we know and what it is that we are speculating.
Can I end on a kind of a positive note? Were there feedback, aside from what you mentioned about the positive, the pro-social feedback from their peers, were there other positive feedback from the survey that you were surprised, maybe even positively surprised by?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, a lot of the numbers about kids' religious engagement and involvement mm-hmm. might have hoped for, but I don't know if we would have counted on. There's a lot of hand-wringing in our community about our teenagers and what's going to be with them and where are they going and oy me hayalanu. And what we actually saw from our data, a lot of teenagers who describe their Judaism as meaningful to them, a lot of teenagers who describe themselves as positively involved in their Judaism, a much higher percentage than we might have expected, given if you remember all the communal angsting about half Shabbos a few years back. Remember that was like a thing to
yeah.
be really worked
yeah, like about. Texting and stuff on Shabbos.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we gave kids a survey about Shabbat observance. And again, good old Jake Trumbo in Utah, who this man, I don't really know what he knows about Shabbat observance. So again, Utah's not a super, you know, high Jewish population state. And we gave kids a survey that asked you keep Shabbat strictly halachically, keep Shabbat, try to keep Shabbat most of the time, but don't always. Keep Shabbat, but use electronics and turn on light. Don't keep Shabbat. Don't know. Those were the choices. And the number of kids who either said, I keep a strictly halachic Shabbat or I keep a strictly halachic Shabbat most of the time, but not always, was about 90%. The number of kids who said, I keep Shabbat, but I turn on lights or use electronics was a single digit percentage of kids. So that means that we have almost all of our kids say, by their understanding of it, they're either keeping Shabbos all the time or they're trying to keep Shabbos and they occasionally slip off. The number of kids who say, nope, my version of Shabbos is I use devices on Shabbos and that's what I do, is actually a very low percentage. When we ask about keeping kashrut, also similarly high percentages of kids who are self-reporting as observing kashrut by whatever their standard understanding is. The percentage of kids who talk about wanting to be as observant as their parents are when they grow up or more observant than their parents, again, those are very high numbers as opposed to kids who say they want to be less observant or not observant at all. And so what our data, and this I think gets back to what's so interesting. If you thought of kids binge drinking as a rebellion against religion, family, community, you would find this data very surprising. What I think our data are telling us, and again, this is my interpretation, so you can take it or leave it. But I think that what our data are telling us are that kids can be very positively connected to family, community, Judaism, and drinking very heavily. They are not experiencing that as a sign of not connecting to family, community, Judaism. That might be because they're actually doing the drinking in a context of family, community, Judaism. Mm-hmm. It might be that they're doing their drinking off by themselves with their friends, but based on what they pick up about family or community or Jewish values around drinking, they think it's fine to be doing the drinking they're drinking and still feel connected. And so for us, that's both the point of challenge and, oh, I hate this, like challenge and opportunity, but I guess it is, right? I know that's so...
It's so bad, cliche, yeah.
Bad business school cliche.
Yeah.
The challenge is the kids are bought in and they're still doing stuff we don't want them to do. And the opportunity is the kids are bought in. So then it's not about saying to the kids, you're bad and you're terrible, or to their parents, or to their schools, or to everyone. I'll say again, a public health approach rejects the, you know, telling people you're doing... It's about what's going on in our whole community's messages and our whole community's norms and the values our whole community is conveying, that parents and kids and adults, children, everybody think that they can be doing both of these things and that it's consistent. And if we want to shift what's going on for the whole community, how do we shift what's going on for the whole community? And not in the direction of teetotaling and nobody should ever touch us with alcohol. That's clearly not how the Jewish community runs or how we're trying to get it to run, but in the direction of a healthier set of communal norms for everybody.
So Dr. Press-Schwartz, thank you. This was really fascinating, really insightful. Do you have any projects on the horizon, writing projects or otherwise?
My heart circle will tell you that I always have a few too many projects on the horizon and I should finish up with them and stop starting more of them. And he would not be wrong. I'll say it again. One of the great joys of Machon Siach in my life is the opportunity that it gives me as a high school educator to also get involved in things like this. So you mentioned the 1840 podcast. Yep. I'm deeply involved with one foot in Machon Siach and one foot in the Shalom Hartman Institute. of thinking about race in the Orthodox community and how we think about and engage around race. I'm working on writing something about that. We'll see what that ever materializes into or where that ever comes from. Various other things in the hopper, some of them more internal to the high school specific, and some of them relating more from the modern Orthodox high school out into the broader modern Orthodox world.
Okay, great. Those sound really interesting.
As always, there's Twitter, which if Twitter got a little bit less of my writing energy than other writing projects might get a little bit more.
That's good. You should just collect your tweets and just kidding. All right.
Sometimes I actually do. I have written long Twitter threads about race in the Orthodox community, which are sort of, the Rashi Prakim, the kind of chapter headings of what it is.
Right. It's like a backbone. It's like a backbone to an article or an essay waiting to happen.
Then you got to devote the work to actually turn that into something. So I am working on that now.
Oh, there you go. Awesome. Wonderful. All right. Well, Dr. Press Schwartz, thank you so much. This was really fantastic.
Really, really my pleasure.
And L'chaim.
L'chaim.
L'chaim.